Welcome to Learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver in Washington. Today on the show, we hear a frightening short story. Shep O'Neill reads The Telltale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe. The story was published in 1843, but it remains a popular read today. Also on the program, Ashley Thompson and I take you to a national park in Colorado that may be enjoyed by birds more than any other animal species. Much of Black Canyon is difficult for humans to explore. But first, a report about some new, unusual places to see live music performances in the United States. You might even want to get a haircut at the same time. Dorothy Gundy explains.
Enjoying a musical performance no longer requires a costly ticket or a trip to a theater. These days, musicians are performing in private homes, at haircutting shops, at airports, even on ferry boats. Musicians like house concerts. At music clubs, they often have to perform over loud conversation or deal with people who have had too much alcohol. People at house concerts are more focused on listening to the music. Just a few hours before the Bombadils started singing at the O'Hare Salon, Lindsay was cutting hair and Tamara was doing facials. Then they moved chairs and microphones to create a small performance space. The Bombadils made music in the front part of the hair salon near the hair dryers and makeup table. "This is our first show at a hair salon," Sarah Frank of the Bombadils told concertgoers at last week's performance. Frank said she and band members Luke Frazier and Caitlin Raitz had a great time interacting with the audience. "Maybe one day we will play bigger venues," Frank said. "If that is the case, we hope our experience playing in small venues will help us remember the real reason we are playing music." Concerts in people's homes or small businesses, such as O'Hare's, are becoming more popular, musicians say. "There is a more relaxed atmosphere," said Dominic Sakala, a musician who opened up his O'Hare salon to concerts. "People really get to know the artists." Kat Parsons is a Maryland-based singer-songwriter who enjoys performing at house concerts. "House concerts have an intimacy that is so rewarding as a performer," Parsons said. She said performers can take their time, tell stories, and talk with concertgoers. For Parsons, that usually means lots of laughing. She explains that one of her songs, "Talk to Me," is based on an ex-boyfriend who was unwilling to say what he was really thinking. "Being a singer-songwriter is a great way to have the last word on a failed relationship," she joked. At house concerts, people get time before and after concerts to meet the performers. Often, the hosts or guests will provide food and drink. Libby Schrader is a New York City-based singer-songwriter. "House concerts are the best possible way to tour for independent musicians," Schrader said. "At music clubs, the owners take a share of money made from ticket sales," Schrader said. "But all the money goes to the performer when people pay to attend a house concert." At a house concert, the host is usually doing it for the love of the music. Often, the crowd will pass a container to fill with donations. Schrader said the performers get the full amount. Matt Hart and Aubrey Zoli make up Local Strangers, a folk rock group based in Seattle, Washington. The duo often performs at house concerts, but they also have performed at more unusual places. For example, they sang for travelers at Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. They also made music on a former ferry now used for boat tours of the city's lakes. Hart said their voices echoed as they floated under bridges. Hart loves house concerts. He describes it as showing up at a party and not knowing most of the people. People really like listening to music in the living room of a friend, Hart said. At many such concerts, the duo does not need microphones. Yet every word of their songs can be heard. People at house parties often are more likely to buy music and other products from performers because the audience can get to know the artists. That extra money is important for musicians, most of whom struggle to make a living. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Our National Parks journey this week takes us to the western state of Colorado. There, you will find a 77-kilometer-long canyon. Its exposed rocks are among the oldest you will find on Earth. The canyon is so narrow and so deep that sunlight shines only briefly at the bottom at midday. That frequent darkness is what has given this canyon its name. Welcome to Black Canyon of the Gunnison National Park.
Black Canyon seems impossibly steep and narrow. The fast-moving Gunnison River formed the canyon over millions of years. As the river flows through the canyon, it drops an average of 18 meters per kilometer. The Gunnison River loses more elevation in its 77-kilometer canyon stretch than the Mississippi River does in 2,400 kilometers from Minnesota to the Gulf of Mexico. This loss in elevation causes the river to gain speed and force. Over time, that force has carved and cut the hard rock and created the wild and jagged rock formations found at Black Canyon. That process is known as erosion. At its widest, Black Canyon is 14 kilometers. At its deepest point, it is 829 kilometers from the canyon edge to the floor.
Black Canyon attracted little attention from early Western explorers. In fact, no early Spanish explorers to the southwestern United States reported seeing Black Canyon. The first written record about the canyon came in 1873. The Ute Indians certainly knew of Black Canyon, but only its rim, never the gorge, shows evidence of past human occupation. Even today, the depth and steepness of Black Canyon make it extremely difficult for humans to access.
Birds, however, have no problem surviving in the canyon environment. Black Canyon is home to many kinds of birds. They live at the canyon rim, along its walls, and by the river. Mountain bluebirds and great horned owls live in the rim area. The owls eat seeds and berries from the pinyon, juniper, and oak trees found there. Canyon wrens sing loudly within Black Canyon. Visitors are more likely to hear the birds than see them. They build their nests on flat surfaces of the canyon walls. So do peregrine falcons. They prey on other birds. They dive at speeds up to 300 kilometers per hour to catch them. American dippers build their nests in the gorge next to the Gunnison River. A gorge is a narrow valley between hills or mountains. These dippers feed on insects and small fish.
Some people come to Black Canyon of the Gunnison National Park for world-class bird watching. But it is the canyon itself that appeals to most visitors. Walking along the rim, seeing the canyon's towering cliffs, and hearing the powerful flow of the Gunnison River far below is an overwhelming experience. At Black Canyon, visitors can view some of the planet's oldest exposed rocks. They are Precambrian rocks. Precambrian accounts for the Earth's history from its very beginning up until about 540 million years ago. Precambrian rocks are described as basement rocks because they are usually buried deep under the surface. They only become exposed when younger rocks have been cut away by erosion or other forces. At Black Canyon, the Gunnison has eroded the canyon walls so greatly that Precambrian rocks have become visible. Often, the canyon's rock walls look like works of art. Different kinds of rocks fold together and form colorful patterns. The patterns change as sunlight hits different parts of the walls. One area of the canyon is known as Painted Wall. It is the highest cliff in Colorado. Long pink bands of rock cover this section of the canyon, as if a person took a paintbrush to the wall. This pattern formed as hot liquid from below the Earth's surface forced its way into rock cracks. As it slowly cooled, large crystals formed. The bands get their pink color from a crystallized mineral called potassium feldspar.
Local people knew just how special Black Canyon was. They began urging Congress to protect the canyon in the 1930s. It became a national monument in 1933. And in 1999, it became a national park. The park protects more than 22 kilometers of the canyon. Most visitors spend their time exploring the canyon rim by foot or by car. Several kilometers of trails lead to many overlook points. A road also leads to several breathtaking views. The U.S. Congress named the lands below the canyon rim a wilderness preservation system. This is meant to protect forever the land's natural conditions.
Some adventurous travelers choose to explore this wilderness by hiking down to the inner canyon. There are no marked trails to guide them. Hikers must first get a wilderness use permit. These permits are free, but only a limited number are available each day. Many of the paths are difficult to follow. Some are also dangerous. The Warner Point Trail, for example, drops more than 820 meters. Walking down takes more than 2 hours. Walking back up can take up to 4 hours. The Park Service warns that poison ivy grows wildly in the inner canyon. There is also the risk of falling rocks. But to reach a place where no humans ever tried to live is the reward.
Now it's time for an American story. Here is Shep O'Neill with The Telltale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe.
True. Nervous. Very, very nervous I have been, and am. But why will you say that I am mad? The disease had sharpened my senses, not destroyed them. Above all, it was the sense of hearing. I heard all things in the heaven and in the earth. I heard many things in the underworld. How then am I mad? Observe how healthily, how calmly, I can tell you the whole story. It is impossible to say how first the idea entered my brain. I loved the old man. He had never wronged me. He had never given me insult. For his gold, I had no desire. I think it was his eye. Yes, it was this. He had the eye of a bird, a vulture, a pale blue eye with a film over it. Whenever it fell on me, my blood ran cold, and so, very slowly, I made up my mind to take the life of the old man and free myself of the eye forever. Now, this is the point. You think that I am mad. Madmen know nothing. But you should have seen me. You should have seen how wisely and carefully I went to work. I was never kinder to the old man than during the whole week before I killed him. And every night, late at night, I turned the lock of his door and opened it, oh, so gently. And then, when I had made an opening big enough for my head, I put in a dark lantern, all closed, that no light shone out. And then I stuck in my head. I moved it slowly, very slowly, so that I might not interfere with the old man's sleep. And then, when my head was well in the room, I undid the lantern just so much that a single thin ray of light fell upon the vulture eye. And this I did for 7 long nights, but I found the eye always closed. And so it was impossible to do the work, for it was not the old man who was a problem for me, but his evil eye. On the eighth night, I was more than usually careful in opening the door. I had my head in and was about to open the lantern when my finger slid on a piece of metal and made a noise. The old man sat up in bed, crying out, "Who's there?" I kept still and said nothing. I did not move a muscle for a whole hour. During that time, I did not hear him lie down. He was still sitting up in the bed, listening, just as I have done, night after night. Then I heard a noise, and I knew it was the sound of human terror. It was the low sound that arises from the bottom of the soul. I know the sound well. Many a night, late at night, when all the world slept, it has welled up from deep within my own chest. I say I knew it well. I knew what the old man felt, and I felt sorry for him, although I laughed to myself. I knew that he had been lying awake ever since the first noise when he had turned in the bed. His fears had been, ever since, growing upon him. When I had waited a long time without hearing him lie down, I decided to open a little, a very, very little crack in the lantern. So I opened it. You cannot imagine how carefully, carefully. Finally, a single ray of light shot from out and fell full upon the vulture eye. It was open, wide, wide open, and I grew angry as I looked at it. I saw it clearly, all a dull blue with a horrible veil over it that chilled my bones. But I could see nothing else of the old man's face or person, for I had directed the light exactly upon the damned spot. And have I not told you that what you mistake for madness is but a kind of oversensitivity? Now, there came to my ears a low, dull, quick sound, such as a watch makes when inside a piece of cotton. I knew that sound well, too. It was the beating of the old man's heart. It increased my anger, but even yet I kept still. I hardly breathed. I held the lantern motionless. I attempted to keep the ray of light upon the eye, but the beating of the heart increased. It grew quicker and quicker and louder every second. The old man's terror must have been extreme. The beating grew louder, I say, louder every moment. And now, at the dead hour of the night, in the horrible silence of that old house, so strange a noise as this excited me to uncontrollable terror. Yet for some minutes longer I stood still, but the beating grew louder, louder. I thought the heart must burst, and now a new fear seized me. The sound would be heard by a neighbor. The old man's hour had come. With a loud shout, I threw open the lantern and burst into the room. He cried once, once only. Without delay, I forced him to the floor and pulled the heavy bed over him. I then smiled to find the action so far done. But for many minutes, the heart beat on with a quiet sound. This, however, did not concern me. It would not be heard through the wall. At length, it stopped. The old man was dead. I removed the bed and examined the body. I placed my hand over his heart and held it there many minutes. There was no movement. He was stone dead. His eye would trouble me no more. Thank you. If still you think me mad, you will think so no longer when I describe the wise steps I took for hiding the body. I worked quickly, but in silence. First of all, I took apart the body. I cut off the head and the arms and the legs. I then took up three pieces of wood from the flooring and placed his body parts under the room. I then replaced the wooden board so well that no human eye, not even his, could have seen anything wrong. There was nothing to wash out, no mark of any kind, no blood whatever. I had been too smart for that. A tub had caught all. When I had made an end of these labors, it was 4 o'clock in the morning. As a clock sounded the hour, there came a noise at the street door. I went down to open it with a light heart, for what had I now to fear? There entered three men, who said they were officers of the police. A cry had been heard by a neighbor during the night. Suspicion of a crime had been aroused. Information had been given at the police office, and the officers had been sent to search the building. I smiled, for what had I to fear? The cry, I said, was my own, in a dream. The old man, I said, was not in the country. I took my visitors all over the house. I told them to search well. I led them at length to his room. I brought the chairs there and told them to rest. I placed my own seat upon the very place under which lay the body of the victim. The officers were satisfied. I was completely at ease. They sat, and while I answered happily, they talked of common things. But after a while I felt myself getting weak and wished them gone. My head hurt and I had ringing in my ears, but still they sat and talked. The ringing became more severe. I talked more freely to do away with the feeling, but it continued until at length I found that the noise was not within my ears. I talked more, and with a heightened voice, yet the sound increased, and what could I do? It was a low, dull, quick sound like a watch makes when inside a piece of cotton. I had trouble breathing, and yet the officers heard it not. I talked more quickly, more loudly, but the noise increased. I stood up and argued about silly things in a high voice and with violent hand movements, but the noise kept increasing. Why would they not be gone? I walked across the floor with heavy steps, as if excited to anger by the observations of the men. But the noise increased. What could I do? I swung my chair and moved it upon the floor. But the noise continually increased. It grew louder, louder, louder. And still the men talked pleasantly and smiled. Was it possible they heard not? No, no, they heard. They suspected. They knew. They were making a joke of my horror. This, I thought, and this, I think. But anything was better than this pain. I could bear those smiles no longer. I felt I must scream or die. And now, again, louder, louder, louder. Villains, I cried, pretend no more. I admit the deed. Tear up the floorboards. Here, here, it is the beating of his hideous heart.
I'm Katie Weaver. That's all the time we have for the show today. But we'll be back tomorrow with another Learning English program on the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us.
It's music time.